Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
You're listening to the Co-Main Event Podcast. And now your hosts, Ben Folks and Chad Dundas.
That's right. You're listening to another episode of the Co-Main Event Mixed Martial Arts Podcast. I'm Chad Dundas. That's Ben Folks. We're both longtime MMA journalists, and for the last 9 years, we've been meeting here every single week to break down all the action in the wild, weird, and occasionally wonderful world of mixed martial arts. Ben, you'll note that in the introduction, I omitted the word nearly when I talk about how long we've been doing this show. And that's because it's the CME's birthday this week.
Is that a fact? I had no idea.
Yep, no, we're close. Obviously not the exact day, but okay. Yeah, 9 years ago this week.
When is the exact day?
I believe it is the 22nd or 23rd. So this Saturday or Sunday will be the Co-Main Event Podcast's actual birthday, I think. You know, you and I are notoriously great at keeping track of this kind of stuff. So yeah. I could be completely wrong. But I don't know. It's going to be like Jesus's birthday, man. We're just going to decide to celebrate it this week and say that it's...
I'm glad you made that analogy.
Nine years that we've been doing this show.
It will be a lot like Jesus's birthday. Frankly, because that's kind of an apples to apples comparison, honestly. But hey, I'll take your word for it on when the CME's birthday is. And I'll just say, you think of what I'm thinking? Sheet cake.
Yeah, I was just going to say sheet
Supermarket
cake.
Supermarket sheet cake.
Yeah. In this one instance, I was actually thinking what you were thinking.
Yeah.
Giant.
We get our,
supermarket.
Both of our faces on there, a CME logo. Maybe we get like, get them to put an icing hashtag Tracy time in there or some shit like that. And, we have ourselves a celebration.
Yeah, we go get one of those big tubs of ice cream you can get over at Winco now. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm excited. I'm excited for the CME birthday celebration. It's turning 9, so it's probably going to want some toys and I don't know, maybe a tablet, just judging from my own 9-year-old, what she wants.
Is this the age we have to start arguing with it about whether or not it can have a cell phone?
Yeah, screen time. We're going to have to start putting some real limitations on screen time here. We got a lightweight
bonanza. I just can't
wait
for it to get old enough that we can set it out in the world and it can fend for itself. That's what I'm looking forward to.
Yeah, me too. We got a lightweight bonanza on the program this week, Ben. Not only did we crown a 155-pound champion over the weekend at UFC 262, Charles Oliveira obviously defeats Michael Chandler. You got Beneil Dariush also taking out Tony Ferguson to establish himself as one of the elite fighters in that division. But, man, you just look around, the Shark Tank, noted as MMA's most competitive division, and big things are happening right now in the lightweight division.
Yeah, and just frankly, a division where you can kind of put all the names in a hat, just shake it up, pull two out, and you come up with a crackerjack of a fight.
Yeah, no, you really
I can't complain about that.
Remember, you're listening to the Co-Main Event Podcast proper. This podcast drops every Monday, in your podcast libraries or timelines. And if you think we're having fun right now, you need to check us out over at patreon.com/co-main event. We're over there rocking with 3 additional podcasts every single week. If you don't get your MMA fix from this show, you can check out the Wednesday live chat or the Friday Power Hour. And of course, every Thursday, we got the Movie Club podcast. That's for the true heads, the top tier patrons of the Co-Main Event podcast. This week, seeing as how it's Grab Bag Movie Month, we're going to be watching The Raid, which I understand is a martial arts classic of sorts.
Yeah, the people demanded it, frankly.
They did.
We didn't really have much say in the matter.
The people grabbed us by the scruff of our necks and said, listen, we're watching The Raid this week.
Yeah, it's basically like the podcast version of when Suge Knight held Vanilla Ice out the window by his legs.
That's another apples to apples comparison. We're on a roll so far. Mm-hmm.
We had no choice but to agree.
You know what you can feel right now is 9 years of podcast chemistry just happening live as we record this. It's amazing.
You can't buy that kind of experience. But you could buy this podcast, which has that kind of experience. So just keep that in mind if you're a wealthy Silicon Valley investor.
Speaking of buying stuff, if you really want to support the team, I'd love it if you'd buy my newest novel, The Blaze, wherever books are sold. Publishers Weekly called it an exceptional thriller. The plot soars with each believable twist and realistic characters worth rooting for. So go out and grab The Blaze today. Remember, if you have read it or you do read it and you enjoy it, go leave a 5-star review over at Amazon or Goodreads or wherever you like. Those reviews do help the book. So do me a favor. Buy, read, rate, review The Blaze. Wherever is best for you. We got music this week from our guys Foreign Cache. That's C-A-C-H-E, an LA-based production duo. If you like what you hear from Foreign Cache on the show, you can check out more of their stuff at foreigncache.bandcamp.com. or soundcloud.com/foreigncache. Again, C-A-C-H-E in the word cash. 3 rounds as usual this week in the Co-Main Event podcast. In round number 1, all hail King Chuck. After almost 11 years and nearly 30 UFC fights, the Charles Oliveira era is finally underway. So that was a bit of a slow burn. And in round number 2, Beneil Dariush is that dude, and he'd like to dedicate this big win to the victims of Marxist ideology and also call out Elon Musk. And why is every single person involved in this sport such a fucking weirdo, man? It's exhausting. And in round number 3, it's like lightweight felt featherweight breathing down its neck as potentially the most interesting division in the UFC and said, hold my beer, motherfucker. We got King Chuck. We got Poirier versus McGregor. We got Beneil Dariush. We got Mikey C in the place to be. We got Justin Gaethje. And you know it's not like T. Ferg is just going to say cool and peace out the game. Shit is shaping up to be very interesting in this division for the rest of the year. And we'll talk about what happens next. All that plus are you fucking kidding me and just saying stuff. But first, like we always do about this time, let's do a little bit of listener mail.
Listener mail.
First piece of listener mail this week comes from beloved patron of the Co-Main Event podcast, Isaac Spooner. His subject line on the email says, Barboza brutally batters Burgos. So,
okay,
you know we're going to get down with that alliteration right there.
Yeah, that's how you catch our attention. That and being a Patreon.
He writes, fellas, well, it finally happened. Edson Barboza knocked someone out with a punch. Fittingly, for such a rare cosmic event, it was some weird shit. Please discourse. This, Ben, was some weird shit with Edson Barboza's 3rd round KO of Shane Burgos. As I tweeted on Saturday night, it looked like Edson Barboza pulled the power cord out from Shane Burgos, but it still took a second for the light to fade out of his eyes, where Shane Burgos's brain realized that he had been knocked out. He stumbled backwards, bounced off the cage, and then Edson Barboza comes up and you know, gets the stoppage there on the ground. A big win for Barboza, a guy who now is looking like he might be someone to contend with at featherweight. But just how weird was this knockout, man?
Yeah, I mean, because he hits him with just a stinging 1-2 combination. And credit, I guess, to Burgos, because he no-sells it pretty well at first.
Yeah.
And it's like you can see him just focusing really hard on not showing that you're hurt, trying to stay in it, but his body just can't do it. His body, it seems like he manages to keep himself up as long as he does through sheer force of will. And it's like one of those, you're drunk and you're telling yourself, I feel like I might have to vomit, but no, I'm not going to. I'm absolutely not going to. And you're fighting it. And then your body just says, you know what? We're taking over here. Something's got to give. And he just sort of fades back. And I mean, it reminded me a little, like, especially the look on his face as he's trying to, like, really grit down and stay upright. I remember once a Brazilian dude running, like, a jiu-jitsu and MMA class I was in. He used to have us practice spinning around, getting ourselves really dizzy, and then quickly standing up and putting our fists up in fighting position and, like, trying not to stagger, trying not to visibly show that you are wounded. You know, tougher than you think. An interesting thing to try to practice. And you could see, like, Burgos was trying to do it. And he was, like, doing an impressive job for the force of that punch. But then just his legs just couldn't stay with it. And the vertigo, it seemed, like, kind of overtook him. When you see a guy go down like that, that's just scary to watch. Because you do have to wonder what really happened in his brain there. Is he okay after that? And he claims that he is. I mean, he said that basically, like, he had a bruised tibia or something. That was the worst damage he suffered. Said that they went to the hospital afterwards and at least claimed that he didn't have a concussion. But it's scary to watch a guy go down like that.
Yeah, it was. It might have been the longest delayed reaction knockout that I've ever seen. You know, because we've seen some of those KOs before, but this one was really pronounced in terms of the amount of time that passed between Edson Barboza landing the punch and Shane Burgos's body realizing that it needed to take a rest. So it was pretty weird to see. It was very arresting to see it happen that way. And I couldn't tell, like, if Burgos just got knocked out and, like, it took his body a second to react, or if it was just that his equilibrium got kind of screwed up and he was trying to fight through it, but in the end just couldn't really keep his balance. But it was very strange. One of the stranger things that I've seen just in terms of a knockout in this business for a while. Of course, those two guys get fight of the night honors on this UFC 262 card, and Edson Barboza notches what should be, I think, by all rights, his third consecutive win since moving to featherweight. But he had that split decision loss to Dan Ige back in May of last year, but now wins over Marquan Amirkhani and Shaden Burgos. So things are looking up, I think, for Edson Barboza there at 145 pounds.
Yeah, and he frankly looked great in this fight, just he kind did. Of all the way around. So yeah.
Next question this week comes to us from Trevor Finch, who writes, "Well, my longtime guy, Wind Whispers, Jacare, got his whole arm shit broke. I came into this one wanting a win for him, but the MMA gods saw otherwise. With the UFC being cut happy, is it possible we just saw his last fight in the UFC?" Before we talk about what will ultimately be the fate of Jacare Souza after this kind of nasty technical submission armbar loss to Andre Muniz here in the featured prelim at UFC 262. Let's just talk for a second about this submission, man. This was nasty. Like, Andre Muniz just snapped his arm and you could hear it on the broadcast. Yeah. And then possibly my favorite thing about it was Jacare standing up, smiling, giving the guy a hug, acting like getting his arm broke was no big deal in the immediate aftermath of that.
Not only could you hear it, but from the sort of reverse angle, you could see the moment it snaps, you could see his whole shoulder just drop. Like where the whole structural integrity of his arm kind of gives in right at that moment. And man, that was bad. And it also felt like it kind of came out of nowhere. It wasn't like one of those, usually when we see an arm bar where somebody gets their arm broken, you kind of see it coming.
Yeah.
You see it slowly developing where you're going, this son of a bitch isn't going to tap, is he? He's going to make us watch his arm turn into a twist tie. And I hate that. It's one of the things I've learned to deal with so much other stuff, so much human wreckage that we've gotten used to in MMA. And for some reason, somebody allowing their arm to just get bent all out of shape really messes with me more than anything. But this one, it felt like, you know, the guy's going for it, but it didn't really seem like you knew Jacare was in obvious peril right up until it snapped. Yeah. And, you know, I was up in Kalispell working on a story for this one, so I was kind of following along on Twitter and watching fight videos and stuff on as soon as they were over as I could do it. And I was up there with a friend of mine who owns the SBG Whitefish Gym and teaches MMA and jiu-jitsu and stuff up there. And he was like, well, have you seen the video of Jacare getting his arm broke in the Mundial's finals against Hodger Gracie? And I was like, no, I hadn't. So he pulls it up on his phone. Like later, we're watching it, you know, gi jiu-jitsu. They're in there. Hodger Gracie gets him in an arm bar off his back in the guard. And they kind of end up like rolling out of bounds as Jacare is trying to escape, but like gets his arm damaged in that one. And then just like tucks it into the belt, tucks the useless now arm into his belt, goes out there with one hand and finishes the match and wins on points. And so maybe it should not have been a surprise to us that Jacare, A, was willing to let his arm get snapped in the pursuit of victory, and B, was really, you know, not even that perturbed by it after it happened. Still yeah. maintained his positive good nature.
Yeah, ain't no thing for Jacare Souza to get his arm busted, apparently. They did reference that that jiu-jitsu incident during the broadcast here. And I think you gotta credit Andre Muniz here, who in the lead up to this fight said that he thought he was the better grappler, which obviously seemed outlandish at the time, but then he went out there and backed it up, had a couple of pretty picture perfect double leg takedowns during this first round, and then eventually finishes with the armbar, nabbing his third straight UFC win plus two in a row on Dana White's Contender Series before he made it to the UFC proper. This is a guy who is not a rookie, man. This is, even though he's just a few fights into his UFC career, he had extensive experience down in Brazil before coming to America, and he has fought at light heavyweight before. At one point during about 2000, let's say 14 to 2016, he nabs, I think, 8 or 9 submission wins in a row, fighting in independent organizations down there in Brazil, has a win over Paulo Filho under his belt here. So a big win, obviously, here to out grapple and score a technical and nasty technical submission over Jacare here, obviously. But Andre Muniz seems like maybe he just established himself as a guy to watch. I don't know.
Well, what do you think about this question, though? Did we see Jacare in the UFC for the last time after that?
Well, I mean, hey, man, it's a cold business, but it would be some cold-blooded shit to call Jacare Souza this week and be like, hey, man, just wanted to check in, see how the arm is, what the timetable is on your recovery, and also your cut. You no longer have a job.
I get that, but this is a cold business, and he's lost 4 straight now.
Yeah.
So, and like, we were thinking of his name back when Dana White said that we were going to see some surprising cuts and some guys with some big names who are going to be cut. Jacare's been around a while, you know, probably making, at least relative for the UFC, pretty good money to show up now. And if you're thinking, well, 4 in a row, we don't know if there is a place for him going forward. Plus, we get, you know, 3 or 4 of these young guys in here for the price of 1 Jacare. I could see how the UFC would do the math on that one, and the end result is Sean Shelby has to call him up and have that exact conversation.
Yeah. Sometimes, I guess, if you're Sean Shelby, you got to have those phone calls. We know that the UFC has been in belt tightening mode a little bit here throughout the Endeavor era. And Jacare, as we noted, I think during last Wednesday's live chat, has that pre-existing relationship with Scotty Coakes from the Strikeforce days. So he could be a guy that could land on his feet somewhere else. I just think, you know, it is a tough business if, number one, you get your arm broke while you're at work on Saturday night, and then they call you up later in the week to tell you no need to come back. We cleared out your locker and sent you a box full of stuff. So we wish you best in your future endeavors. Next question this week comes to us from 60s and 70s singer Burt Bacharach, who writes, okay, snapping Jacare's arm doesn't net you $75,000? Does the UFC want to steer clear of glorifying an injury like this? What did you think of the bonuses as a whole? Love you, dudes. So we inflated the bonuses. The UFC's performance-based post-fight bonuses went from $50,000 to $75,000 for this event. Ironically enough, at the request of Tony Ferguson. During a pre-fight media event, tossed it out there that we should make the the post-fight bonus is $75,000 for this event. Got a big roar from the crowd, as he is so often wont to do. Dana White was like, fine, let's do it. Increases the bonuses. And then, of course, Tony Ferguson doesn't get a piece of it. Your fight of the night was Edson Barboza versus Shane Burgos, which we just talked about. Performances of the night were Charles Oliveira and Christos Gallegos. My feelings about the UFC's post-fight bonus system are well established at this point, and that is we would be better served just taking our yearly post-fight bonus budget and splitting it up among the fighters on the roster and calling it something else just to give these guys a little bit extra money. But this is the system that we trundle forward under, and here you got these winners. But I think there's a lot of sense in this question, man. It doesn't seem like you could have a better or more impactful submission than Andre Muniz here on Jacare Souza. So if I was him, yeah, I might be asking some tough questions about where my $75,000 was at.
Yeah, especially if you're thinking of not only the quality of the submission, but what that submission win means. Like being the first guy to get a submission on Jacare in MMA, that'd be kind of a big deal. You would think that it might be a bigger deal than Christos Gallegos getting a sweet Bravo choke on Sean Soriano to put him to sleep. But in like the curtain jerker, the first fight of the prelims, it seems like there's just a big difference in the size of the fight and the meaning of the submission. Like if you told Andre Muniz that like, hey, the good news, you're going to submit Jacare tonight. And he'd be like, awesome. But he's like, but it won't be the submission of the night. He'd probably be pretty mystified. And he'd probably think, well, the other one must have been absolutely spectacular, right? It must have been somebody just inventing an entirely new submission that we have. It's got to be something amazing. And it was just, it was a good way for Christos Gallegos to get back and win that fight. And when there were some moments where it hadn't gone great for him up until that point, but it wasn't anything like so mind-blowing. So, yeah, I don't know if maybe the UFC, we know how they had changed those bonuses years before from being specifically knockout of the night and submission of the night. And it seemed at the time like maybe the UFC's looking down the road here at concussion lawsuits or some sort of liability issue where somebody's going to go take them to court and point out you actually incentivize people to knock each other unconscious. And so therefore you're responsible for some of these brain issues. And the guy goes out there and get his arm snapped. And if you say, we want to specifically reward that activity, maybe you worry that it looks bad. But also, if I'm Andre Muniz, that would not be much of a comfort to me.
You know?
Though, finally bumping the bonuses up, I'll be interested to see if we just go right back to $50,000 after that. Because they've been at $50,000 for a long time. And you remember back when it used to change per event. It'd be 60,000 sometimes, it'd be above that. And then establishing it as like a blanket 50 and keeping it that way for years and years. And you're like, the $50,000 that you would get as a bonus now isn't worth the same as it was when you first started doing it, like 7-8 years ago, something like that. Maybe it's about time somebody finally nudged that up.
Yeah, also interesting, I know we're going to talk about Christos Gallegos a bit more here in this next question, but he actually might have talked his way into this post-fight bonus here because he jumps on the mic after he catches Sean Soriano in that choke and says, when Dana White sweetens the deal from $50,000 to $75,000, you got to go for broke, basically. So maybe played to the ego of the UFC president a little bit there and in kind gets rewarded with the $75,000 bonus. That leads us here into this question from David Lopan, who is the main antagonist in the 1986 action comedy film Big Trouble in Little China. He is a merciless and conniving sorcerer who just wants to have flesh again in order to rule the universe. So,
okay.
Glad he could take some.
Like, we need to be told who David Lopan is. Remember Lopan?
He writes,
Big Trouble in Little China?
Don't you put that evil on Cowboy Cerrone, Christos Gallegos. So short and sweet here from the main antagonist of the 1986 action comedy film Big Trouble in Little China. A pretty respectful call out, I guess, at least from Christos Gallegos here after he gets the comeback victory over Sean Soriano. But man, I feel like we just processed a whole lot of emotions this past week about Diego Sanchez getting released from the UFC and his fight with Donald Cerrone getting pulled off that card. And we got to try to figure out what's going on with Diego and Josh Fabia. And then Cerrone comes out and loses to Alex Morono. And we're all kind of standing around being like, well, he's probably nearing the end of his rope and he wants one more fight. And Dana White is going to give it to him. And we're all sitting around just thinking, please let's give Cowboy someone else on the senior circuit that he could go out here and maybe bring the boat into harbor with his head up high and we don't have to worry about him suffering too much more damage. And now you got Christos Gallegos, who I have interviewed before and seems like a nice dude, issuing the respectful call out of Cowboy Cerrone here, but I think we all winced a little bit and we're like, nah, man,
yeah,
let's do something else rather than that.
Yeah. If I had my choice, it would be way more seniors tour kind of fight for Donald Cerrone than something like this, because it just seems like, okay, we're going to go out there, probably get Donald Cerrone beat up and be sad all over again. And for what? But then, you know what? I feel like when they gave Donald Cerrone Diego Sanchez, that was an attempt to do the seniors tour kind of fight. And, you know, look what happened. It fell apart and then you end up in there getting blasted by Alex Morono right in the face. So I don't know. I would think that the UFC probably has a little more affection for Donald Cerrone than that. Don't you think?
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe if we're going to book him a senior circuit fight next, we try to do one that does not involve a guy who is potentially involved with a shady spiritual advisor and maybe a little bit less of a cult type situation happening. Maybe we steer clear of any situation like that and we can actually get someone to the cage here for Donald Cerrone to fight. I don't know.
Man, that's a commentary on our sport, isn't it? That the bar we ask you to clear is to be in a little less of a cult type situation with your spiritual advisor / coach.
Actually, it's sort of an interesting situation here in the first fight of the night at UFC 262, where Sean Soriano moved up from 145 pounds and took this fight against Christos Gallegos on short notice. At lightweight, he'd been away from the UFC for 6 years trying to work his way back. And then, you know, they give you the opportunity to do it. He figures he would take this chance and fight Christos Gallegos up a division. He actually afforded himself pretty well during this fight. As we mentioned, that the choke submission was sort of a come from behind thing for Gallegos in the second round. Soriano, he looked pretty sharp with his hands. He stung Gallegos multiple times in the first round. I came away from this fight, you know, not only happy for Christos Gallegos to nab the win here, but also hoping that Sean Soriano gets another shot because, you know, he had been making his way through the independent circuit, trying to get back to the UFC for a long time. So kind of a feel good story for him. I hope we get to see him in his natural weight class against somebody in the UFC at some point later this year.
Yeah, he did look good early in that fight.
Last question this week comes to us from former professional wrestler Iron Mike Sharp. He writes, I can't remember ever hearing a submission like what happened to Jacare in such a manner. Goddamn, that was bad. And then there was the nasty armbar from KGB Lee and the painful look on Tony's face as Dariush was sending his leg ligaments to the dark side. There seems to be an uptick in jiu-jitsu lately and some more sweeping and scrambling submission wrestling like the fight with the fisherman last week. It seemed like the sport was trending down on these styles of matches and scenarios. And as a card carrying member of the Damian Maya Jiu Jitsu on VHS Club, I'm liking the resurgence of it. Ben, obviously as the Jiu Jitsu correspondent for the Co-Main Event podcast, I will kick this one to you. Does it seem to you like the gentle art is having a bit of a renaissance these days?
Well, first of all, let me take a moment to just say Jiu Jitsu. Yeah.
Okay.
That had to be said.
It's insightful. Now,
yeah. I mean, you know, you get somebody out there pulling, like going for heel hooks and we're snapping arms. You know that a lot of members of the Demian Maya VHS of Jiu-Jitsu for MMA Fan Club are taking their shirts off and whipping them around in the living room shouting Jiu-Jitsu.
Yeah.
Like that's a given. That isn't like all caps Jiu-Jitsu, several exclamation points. Now, I do think it's interesting that the way jiu-jitsu is used in MMA has undergone several evolutions, and a lot of them even just in the last like 10 years or so. Because, you know, we got to a point there where basically, with the exception of Ronda Rousey, nobody was even doing arm bars anymore.
Yeah.
Just because like a combination of everybody's pretty good at defending them. You're often going to put yourself on your back in order to go for one and give up a good position. People were just way less likely to be trying to like give up position to go for like a potential fight-ending submission. And it was way more often that we saw somebody hurt with strikes to some extent, or trying to get up off the bottom and give up their back and give up their neck. And we'd see mostly chokes coming from that side. And now you're seeing a little bit more. I mean, you have some specialists who have always been sort of leg lockers and things like that. But I think that there are like another wave of evolutions coming, where people who are really adept at all these other aspects of the game are also realizing like, okay, there are some openings for me here where I can attempt some of this stuff. But also like I think one of the big changes you see, especially when it comes to arm bars kind of stuff, is like, if you were going for an arm bar in an MMA fight, in a cage fight at the UFC level, you better be going for it with the attitude of like, I'm going to grab your arm and immediately break it. Like, I'm not going to grab your arm and try to extend it and see if you realize that you're fucked. Because at that level, you can't approach it like that. You need to, anytime you're going for that arm bar, you better have it in your mind to just break that shit right away. And even then, I mean, we've seen people who can get extended pretty badly in submissions. I'm sure we'll talk about Tony Ferguson later. And they can kind of tough it out. But, you know, it's like your guy Helio Gracie said, for the choke, there are no tough guys, Chad. That's why I think that we've seen it kind of just trend in one direction. But I do think that as just a different type of athlete and with a different range of experience and skill sets get in there, I think there are opportunities to bring more different types of submission into MMA.
Yeah. I guess it seems like part of a natural evolution of any sport that people are going to figure out, you know, what is the best strategy under the provided rule set in order to win these fights. And I think, as you said, for a long time, you started to see people choosing positional superiority over taking the risk of going for a submission and losing, you know, the dominant position on the ground or top position or whatever it may be. And people had figured out that, like, with 5-minute rounds and a 10-point must system, that was probably the best way to go about it. Now I do wonder if things are starting to swing back the other way. You heard, again, Christos Gallegos say in his post-fight interview after choking out Sean Soriano that in the past, a lot of times he had passed up what seemed to be promising submission opportunities in order to keep his position. And then he said, but at this point, I feel like I got to go for broke. Like, I'm going for these opportunities. So that's an interesting, you know, maybe a surprising amount of Christos Gallegos content on this week's CME podcast. But at the same time, like, you know, that's one guy anecdotally providing you evidence with like a change in perspective or a change in attitude that like he has realized now maybe he is good enough at submissions that it's worthwhile for him to go for them. So it'll be interesting to see if there's any kind of statistical data to back that up, any kind of resurgence of jiu-jitsu, much to the chagrin, I'm sure, of our guy Sean Sheehan over there in Ireland, a noted practitioner of the point of view that jiu-jitsu doesn't work. So he's not loving it right now.
I think you've also seen it. It's not just in terms like an evolution in terms of like what submissions people go for. Like, you've seen a major evolution in that almost no one really bases their game around trying to pass the guard and advance into more dominant positions the way we used to, the way right. Like jiu-jitsu basically teaches you. And like, I still remember talking to Coach Robert Fallis about it, and when I was doing a story on him and Extreme Couture, and I was still doing a lot of jiu-jitsu at the time, and it's like, he's a black belt. Let me ask him, like, one of these problems that I face a lot, where I was like, okay, give me some of your tips about, like, defeating the knee shield and moving to, like, side control. And he was like, why? What we practice is, like, if I can get to half guard and hold you down that way, I'd rather stay there. Because I feel like I have a much better chance to just like anchor your leg down to the mat, hold you there, beat you up from on top. I'm definitely winning the round, and maybe I make you increasingly desperate, and you give me something in an attempt. And if I go to side control at this level, everybody's so good that they can usually escape from side control. You're really giving them an opportunity to get up off the bottom when you don't have to. And it's just like a completely different sort of way to approach it.
Yeah. That's going to do it for listener mail this week. Remember, if you have a question, comment, or a concern that you would like to air to the podcast in future weeks, you know how to do it. Go to the website, comainevent.com, and click the link in the top right-hand corner of the screen that says email the podcast. That'll get you in touch with us. Right now, we're going to go ahead and get started with round number one. What a treat from Charles Oliveira and Michael Chandler in the main event of UFC 262 for the vacant UFC lightweight title. Charles Oliveira emerges victorious after a second round TKO over Michael Chandler here. Just in an all-action fight with multiple momentum swings, multiple times where both guys looked to be in trouble, multiple times where both guys got to show their strengths and their toughness and their durability. Oh, and all that squeezed into a little bit less than 5 minutes and 20 seconds. Been a whole lot of living here from Charles Oliveira and Michael Chandler, considering they spent a fairly short time together in this championship fight. What'd you think of the bout? What do you think now about King Chuck reigning over the 155-pound weight class?
Yeah, you're not lying about a whole lot of living packed into that fight, because it seemed like a fight that was nothing but swings. Just big swings in each direction where, you know, you got Chandler trying to deal with Oliveira being on his back, seemed like in a tough situation. I think if you told Michael Chandler that he would spend a portion of round one right off the bat when he doesn't have a good sweat going or anything, with Charles Oliveira on his back with a body triangle, he'd be like, well, oh no. That probably does not bode well for me to have the all-time submission leader in the UFC stuck to your back right off the bat in the first round. And then he ends the first round by looking like he has Oliveira really hurt and like he might be close to a finish himself. I love, too, Charles Oliveira when he gets rocked and he's down there on all fours doing the Nick Diaz head movement even on the ground thing.
Yeah,
that we saw from that Paul Daly fight, you know, just showing him you're still in it, showing him that you're still aware and not just staying in one spot and taking those hard shots. And Chandler, it seemed like he had a moment there like late in the first round where he had Charles Oliveira on his back up against the fence and he had an opportunity to just sort of try to keep pouring on the punches, but and maybe smartly recognize, I don't know if I want to just recklessly dive into this guy's guard and, you know, be just trying to swing wildly. I want to like take care here. Don't spend everything you have right off the bat and don't get yourself submitted just because you think you might be closer to a finish than you are. But then, you know, right off the bat, when you start the second round, that sneaky left hook that Charles Oliveira lands, it's just like a long whip, like a snake bite that just reaches out and catches Michael Chandler right as he is sort of floating backwards and on all, like both feet sort of coming off the mat right as he gets hit. And that just does not give you much of a chance to take that blow. And yeah, he never gets back in it after that. And Charles Oliveira just puts it on him and keeps hammering him with that left hand as he's trying to escape. And that's just a really pretty masterful performance by Charles Oliveira, showing that he can hurt you a lot of different ways.
Yeah, it's just an insane finishing sequence from Oliveira where he floored Michael Chandler with that hook and then followed up with a flurry of punches and a knee and a couple of hard right hands and then that additional left hook that put Michael Chandler down for good. And then, man, you know, one of the feel-good championship celebrations, I guess, of all time, shades of Jose Aldo here, where Charles Oliveira jumps over the cage and has some words for the broadcast team, runs over and smears blood on Dana White, and then runs into the crowd, gives Reed Harris a big kiss when Reed Harris is going out there to pull him out of the crowd. And it's got to feel good for Charles Oliveira who has had as long a road from UFC debut to championship moment as anyone in the history of the sport, man. And at this point has developed into a guy who is obviously dangerous in all areas, you know, and he looks patient, but just like deadly technical as a striker who also has an extremely dangerous submission game where he is able to put his opponents in sort of a pick your poison situation now. And, you know, for Michael Chandler, in some ways was able to finish this fight on the feet, where I think we thought Michael Chandler might have a power advantage. We saw some of that in the first round, but just like the way this thing ended just made me reflect on how dangerous now Charles Oliveira is in almost any position.
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned his long, long road to a UFC title, and I really like seeing it happen this way for some people, because I think too often in this sport, we write people off or we think we've got the book on them. We see them at a certain stage in their careers. We go, okay, we saw this guy, you know, win one, lose two, that kind of stuff. And we go, all right, we've slotted you away into this category of guy who's pretty good, guy who's always going to be around, but never going to be championship caliber. And we don't often enough allow for the possibility that people can change and people can improve. And especially as they get more experience and they really find their identity as a fighter and what they do, and they gain confidence as they start putting wins together. And we don't often enough allow for that possibility that, yeah, maybe that was true of him at a different point in his career, but now things are different. Like, now he's changed and he has gotten a whole lot better. And I think especially we don't account for the power of momentum in a guy's career. Like, when you start really gaining those long win streaks, I think that you see some guys come in there with that sort of confidence that gets them through some of those tough moments. They might get dropped, might get hurt, or be in a bad spot early on, but they've come into a point in their careers when they really believe, and they've got that sort of hot hand that, and I think that counts for more than people think, especially at this level where the difference between, you know, one fighter and another in the UFC top five, especially at a stacked division like lightweight, it's razor thin, the difference in skill and athletic talent.
Yeah, it's a testament to Charles Oliveira's skill that he has been in the UFC for an uninterrupted 11 years now, which is kind of crazy to think about how few fighters not only win championships, but have a tenure, an unbroken tenure in the company for that long. And here is a guy, Ben, who started his UFC career 4-4-1 in his first nine fights. Has losses to Donald Cerrone, Cub Swanson, Frankie Edgar, Max Holloway, Anthony Pettis, Paul Felder. He's had situations where he lost 4 of 6 in 2016, 2017, and then now has righted the ship in the form of 9 straight wins and a UFC title. And man, if you're a fan of this sport, it's just a great story, not only, you know, to hear about Charles Oliveira's childhood of poverty. He kind of fought his way out of that, comes to America, and now becomes the UFC champion. But just in terms of the sport itself, like, a terrific story that Charles Oliveira has these ups and downs, maybe gets shortchanged a time or two, maybe, like you said, starts to seem like a person that we start to think we have seen the best from, or we know what he's capable of, and now he's able to string together this run of wins and become the champion. Like, if you are a fan of this sport, I don't know how you could look at Charles Oliveira and not feel great for the guy. And especially to see him, you know, after the fight is over, and like, he just seems emotionally overwhelmed, and like, he's like, this really means the world to him. And it felt good, man, to see, to end the pay-per-view on this note of Charles Oliveira winning the title and clearly seeing that it means the world to him.
Yeah.
And then, of course, on the flip side, Michael Chandler, just in his second UFC fight, getting this title opportunity, coming up a little bit short. Came out pedal to the metal, highly, highly aggressive, as we know he likes to do. Got knocked down with a low kick early. Oliveira seemed like he was trying to slow him down, but Chandler, you know, for the most part, just kind of bowled right through it. And this dude, man, I tell you what, this guy pulls punches out of his back pocket and throws them at your face like he is trying to reach inside your body and yank out your spine. It is just like an all power, all the time game for Michael Chandler. And you got to see a little bit of what he is capable of in this fight, despite the fact that he, you know, got stunned in the early in the second and ended up losing this thing. And a guy, you know, known as a good talker, I guess, Michael Chandler, very gracious in defeat of this one, talking about how he believes in his heart he's still going to be UFC champion before it's all said and done. Congratulates Charles Oliveira. So even though he lost and lost in the main event of this championship level fight, this is honestly a fight where I come out of it, and I know we'll talk about this in round three, but I come out of this fight excited to see what happens for both these dudes, to be honest with you.
Yeah, well, and, you know, people were asking me a lot afterwards, especially in my mailbag today. They were going, like, oh, what do you think we do with Michael Chandler next? And the thing that everybody keeps bringing up is, how about Michael Chandler versus Justin Gaethje? Just as a fight, you know, a couple guys coming off of losses in UFC title fights. The winner would feel like right back in the mix. The loser slides a little further backward. And for Michael Chandler, he's 35. He's in a division right now where most of the top five guys are around early 30s with around a decade of experience or give or take there and there. Michael Chandler had a lot of good years in Bellator and comes over in the UFC, and it feels like he comes in with this sense that whatever happens for him in the UFC, it's got to happen fast.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't have time on his side really to hang around and let it slowly develop. And you do, when you look at the top five, the good thing you have there, if you're Michael Chandler, is he seems like an exciting matchup for a whole bunch of different people. And maybe you win one, and depending on how else things shake out in the division, maybe you're not that far from getting back there and getting another chance. But it does seem like it helps you a lot to be somebody where we go, you know what? You lost, but we don't have any bad feelings toward you. We still think that you're an exciting guy that we want to have see fight again, but he does not have five more years to hang around and let it develop.
Yeah.
That seems evident.
All right, let's do Are You Fucking Kidding Me? And then we'll move on to round number two. Ben, what's your Are You Fucking Kidding Me this week?
Well, I was watching this video of Derek Lewis showing up at the press conference here at UFC 262. I mean, you know you're not going to have a UFC event in Houston, and Derek Lewis isn't going to drop by in his polo shirt and his ball cap to toss off some memorable quotes. You know, he starts talking about other guys in the division, giving various reasons for, you know, why he dislikes them. Those reasons, by the way, could range from they have too much hair, and as a bald guy, he doesn't like it when people have too much hair, so fuck them. Also, especially singles out Francis Ngannou, saying that he won't buy his pay-per-views because he doesn't want to support him. Won't even stream them, Chad, because if he gets caught streaming them and gets in some kind of legal trouble, man, it would feel even worse if that was all over a Francis Ngannou fight. But the real reason, it seems, Derek Lewis does not like Francis Ngannou, quote, he makes me look fat when I stand next to him. So fuck him. Are you fucking kidding me? Because this, I mean, you know what? As much as I hate this whole thing that we're going to do, where we're going to act like this John Jones thing isn't even happening, we're just going to plow ahead with Francis Ngannou versus Derek Lewis 2 and ignore that massive mega fight that we could make for the heavyweight title, Derek Lewis is going to come in here and promote it in his own special way. And are you fucking kidding me? It actually sort of kind of works on me.
Yeah.
Fucking kidding me?
Are you fucking kidding me? Also, man, take a number, Derek Lewis. We all feel fat standing next to Francis Ngannou, regardless of what physical shape you feel like you're in. We all feel like fat.
The photo, like if you run into Francis Ngannou at the beach, you're both out there in your swim trunks, you get one of your friends to take a picture, you're standing next to the champ, you're doing the fist up pose. That's not the photo you want to put on your Tinder profile. You know, that's not the one. You don't want them to be looking at that photo and be like, well, I wish it was the other one.
I was just confused about who I swiped right on here.
Yeah, because that's the one that you, like, put that one on your personal social media feed or something. But, yeah, that's, as a matter of fact, you run into Francis Ngannou at the beach and you both got your shirts off. Maybe you could just find out where he's going to be later so you can take a picture with him.
Yeah. Well, Ben, speaking of social media, the choo-choo train got back on the tracks this weekend as Caitlin Choo-Choo-Chookagian salts away a unanimous decision victory over Vivian Araujo in a fight that's probably not going to live in our collective consciousness forever. But when I logged on to Twitter on Saturday afternoon, the conversation around Caitlin Chookagian was of a different nature altogether.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
See, what had happened was, it sounds as though, at least to hear the choo-choo herself tell it, somebody hacked her social media accounts a while back and apparently, without Chookagian noticing for a while, went in and hit the old like button on a bunch of posts that were, how do we put this, of a very particular kind of pornography.
Okay.
Are you fucking kidding me? I mean, I gotta be honest. I guess it's kind of like a sneaky and sweet burn, really, as like a very, very low-key hack job, if indeed that's what this was, to go in under someone else's account and like a bunch of tweets that paints a certain kind of picture of that person, because really, how often do you check your own likes? Never, right? Yeah. You never go in and look at your own likes. So,
well, like a only when sneaky... you have used them to bookmark something that you want to find later.
Yeah. So I guess in all seriousness, no, like why they do that? Why somebody do that to the choo-choo Caitlin Chookagian, Ben? You fucking kidding me?
Fucking kidding me? Although, I worried a little bit when I saw her response when she was asked about it before she went on to explain what had happened. Was her first response was a joking, "Hey, I like what I like."
Yeah.
And then I saw later, it was like, people are sharing that, like that headline basically, which if you don't click on it and read the full quote or watch the full video, what you see just scrolling by is that her saying like, "Yeah, I like that and I'd do it again." Because that's what I'm into. And I feel like that might be misrepresenting it a little bit. I mean, I appreciate her willingness to make a joke out of it at first, but also, like, other people, if you're going to report on that one, you owe it to her not to just lead with that and let it go. Like, give her some context on that one.
That's going to do it for round number one. We'll be right back with round number two.
Well, Chad, Benil Dariush had Tony Ferguson in a tough spot. But you know what? Maybe in retrospect, he should have known that Tony Ferguson ain't tapping to shit.
Yeah.
Benil Dariush afterwards would say Tony Ferguson basically went into zombie mode after being heel hooked. And he said, you know, I heard his knee pop and it popped loud. But if you tell me that there's a UFC lightweight out there on the roster who is barely even going to notice when you pop his knee, I'm going to absolutely believe that that person is Tony Ferguson. And I'd be surprised that anybody thought different. But the takeaway here is still that Benil Dariush goes out there and pretty much dominates Tony Ferguson. Unanimous decision, 30-27s across the board. And now Tony Ferguson, who not so long ago was sitting there with like a 12-fight winning streak, is now looking at a 3-fight losing streak. Now, it seems like we all are ready to look at that quick turnaround and go, that's the guy sliding down the backside of his career. However, I would add, you look at the three guys he lost to, Justin Gaethje, and then new champ Charles Oliveira, and now Benil Dariush, there's not a bad fighter in that bunch.
Yeah.
What do you make of where Tony Ferguson is at this point in his career and where he can still go at age 37?
A couple commenters over on the Patreon page have made the point, and I heard Luke Thomas make the point as well earlier today on his show with Brian Campbell. But some of these weaknesses with Tony Ferguson have always been there, right? Like he largely got out wrestled by Kevin Lee. Danny Castillo tested his wrestling. Abel Trujillo tested his wrestling. But in those previous fights, Ferguson was able to do other things to turn the tide, like utilize his submission game to swing things back in his favor. He beat Kevin Lee by submission. He beat Abel Trujillo by submission. He ended up winning a split decision over Danny Castillo. But right now, I think it kind of seems like a couple of different things have happened at once. Like first, Tony Ferguson is 37 years old, as you mentioned, and he has been in 31 professional MMA fights. And it would be foolish, I think, of us to say that those things are not factors, because I think that they quite obviously are. But at the same time, you know, in fights against Justin Gaethje and Charles Oliveira and now Benil Dariush, you are clearly fighting the current cream of the crop, the current upper echelon of fighters at lightweight. And, you know, for the most part, all guys who have incredibly respectable grappling backgrounds. And so maybe some of the stuff that Tony Ferguson could do against Danny Castillo and guys like Kevin Lee just isn't going to work against people like Benil Dariush and Charles Oliveira. And like, I think you saw that on Saturday in an overwhelming performance against Benil Dariush. And like, I think we saw it in the second round when Tony Ferguson tried to go for a Darce choke from full guard, where it's like, maybe in the past he would have pulled that off. And that would have been a surprising victory for Tony Ferguson that we would have slotted among his resume of greatness. But it just, like, you know, with Benil Dariush, he's able to make a couple of small physical adjustments, pop his head out, and then go on with what was like a statement victory for Dariush and an incredibly tenacious performance. So like, I don't think it takes away from Benil Dariush at all to say that, number one, it's possible that at 37 years old, Tony Ferguson has indeed lost a step. And number two, he's fighting guys now who are probably better than the guys that he fought, that he built his amazing win streak against, you know? So, it's a situation, I think, where like not only is he maybe a shade past his prime, although I'm still very interested to see what happens with Tony Ferguson moving forward, but also that like at this point the upper level of 155 pounds is a tough place for him.
Yeah. Well, retroactively, does this make you feel or rest a little easier about the fact that we never got that Tony Ferguson versus Khabib fight? Because I know
100% like, yes.
Yeah.
It does 100% yes. Right, because like, and especially knowing when it would have come around, what version of Tony Ferguson we would have gotten against what version of Khabib Nurmagomedov we would have gotten, like just to see what Charles Oliveira was able to do to him, just to see what Beneil Dariush was able to do to him, just with aggressiveness and top control, and you know a couple submission attempts here and there, but a lot of ground and pound. It's really easy in retrospect, I think, to see, although we will never know for sure, but just to like see in our minds what Khabib would have been able to do and how that fight would have played out. And so I think, you know, it sounds weird to say it, but maybe as like a positive thing, we can kind of let that one go. Like we can take one list off what the one thing off our list of heartbreaks in this sport, because all the while it would have been a cool fight when it happened, I think at this stage we can kind of game plan out how it would have gone.
The one X factor for me though, is like when you say we thinking about what version of Khabib versus what version of Tony Ferguson, that's the part that you can, it was booked so many times, you can pick several different versions that we could have gotten there. I mean, like they were supposed to fight in like 2016, and you could talk yourself into thinking like, well, maybe the 2016 version of Ferguson versus the 2016 version of Khabib is a little more competitive and is a different fight. But you're right that, especially when we were talking about it as in terms of like UFC 249, the last time we had it seriously planned, where instead it ends up being Ferguson versus Justin Gaethje, that version of Ferguson against that version of Khabib, which is better than any previous version. Yeah, that's probably not a competitive fight. I'm willing to strike that off the list of the ones that got away and leave right there at the top, Fedor versus Randy Couture.
I don't want to spend this whole round talking about Tony Ferguson, because Beneil Dariush is the guy, hero, I think deserves the time. He gets the win here. He's got an impressive, like, what is it, 7-fight UFC win streak now. And clearly established himself, if you didn't know it already, as one of the elite fighters in this division. And a guy who I think is exciting to watch. I know that, like, he took some flack from the live crowd. And frankly, like, the Houston live crowd lavished as much love and attention on Tony Ferguson as anyone at this event all week. And so it's not a surprise to hear that from them. But, like, I thought this was a great performance from Beneil Dariush, kind of showing his tenacity, showing his aggressiveness, really going after Tony Ferguson in all areas, both on the feet and on the mat, getting out of danger when he needed to get out of danger, hurt him with strikes, and then, of course, had that knee bar attempt, I believe, in the second round, or I'm sorry, heel hook attempt in the second round that made Tony Ferguson's leg pop in a loud manner that almost anybody else in the world probably would have tapped over. So I feel like in a division that is known for its depth and known for just having a murderer's row of contenders, Beneil Dariush fits right in there, man, as one of these guys that in the coming year I think will be very interesting to see what happens with him.
I mean, are you just saying that because you share his views on Marxism? Is that what, man, this is about?
I tell you what, it's like you can't feel good for 1 second. You can never relax. You can never put your guard down in this sport and be like, well, Beneil Dariush seems like a cool dude that I'm going to be able to get behind. That jumps on the mic at his earliest possible convenience and says some weird stuff about the victims of Marxist ideology, and then challenges Elon Musk to get him the, what, Cybertruck that he's been trying to get or something? I don't even understand the context of the Elon Musk call out, but, just hinting toward the fact that Beneil Dariush is probably into some stuff that I myself am not into.
I just like to imagine in instances like this, Karl Marx in the afterlife, hearing his name brought up, you know, UFC 262, and be like, what did I have? Are you familiar with my works? What the hell, Beneil? I thought we were cool. And just been just totally baffled at what's happening here, because I feel kind of baffled by it, tell you the truth.
The whole thing is baffling. In any case, I guess that's going to be, we need to process our feelings from that as well as we move forward. That's going to do it for round number two. We'll be right back with round number three. Well, Ben, if you were worried about the future of the lightweight division without Khabib Nurmagomedov, I feel like Saturday night stands as a testament that not only are we going to be okay, but we got some fun stuff on tap. And in certain ways, it feels like this division has just merely reloaded with a bunch of fun contenders, a champion that is easy to root for, and now a bunch of fun stuff coming up in the next few months. Let's start first with Conor McGregor versus Dustin Poirier, a fight that no doubt is going to captivate a lot of attention as we get closer to the actual night of it. Clearly, Dustin Poirier beat Conor McGregor in their second fight in a way that seemed fairly emphatic, and then now we got to run back this rematch and do the trilogy for reasons that still seem, you know, somewhat questionable to my mind, but we're all going to make some money and have a fun time. And that's about as much as you can hope for in this sport anymore. But just watching Charles Oliveira beat Michael Chandler in the manner that he did, my brain was already jumping ahead to a potential matchup about Dustin Poirier, because I feel like stylistically that is a fight that is fun as hell. As you think about what could shape up as a potential number one contender fight in this Poirier versus McGregor 3, which one of these guys do you feel like shapes up as the better opponent, and which one of these guys would you rather, if you were the UFC matchmaker, if I gave you a magic wand, which one of these two guys do you think is the better challenger for Charles Oliveira, if indeed that's the way it goes?
For the sake of title legitimacy, I think that it has to be Dustin Poirier, because the problem you have when you have a champion who's undefeated and retires still holding the belt is that then you're going to have this fight for the vacant title. But when you just kind of pick two of the guys who are already in the conversation and then just say, okay, you guys are fighting for the title now, one of you wins it, becomes champ, people are going to come away from it going like, okay, yeah, he won and that was a big fight and everything. But is he really champ? Is he really the best lightweight in the world? And they're not going to be sold on it yet. It's going to take probably more than one fight for that to happen. If Conor McGregor wins this Dustin Poirier rubber match and then gets put right into the title fight, which I don't think is a given if Conor McGregor wins, then I think people will look at it and be like, okay, even if you go out there and you beat Conor McGregor, what has he done lately? I mean, he went 1-2 against Dustin Poirier lately. His last win before that was over, way closer to the end than the beginning version of Donald Cerrone, and got absolutely throttled by Khabib, and I think it'll have a harder time giving you that legitimacy. But Dustin Poirier has been, you know, so good recently, aside from his loss to Khabib. If he goes out here and beats Conor McGregor for a second time and is like, okay, look, I beat this guy twice in like 6 months, yeah, and then you put him into the title fight, if Charles Oliveira could beat him and get that as his first title defense under his belt, I think that helps establish the legitimacy of the new title holder a lot more. But yeah, I also think, like, for reasons we've talked about before, if Conor McGregor wins, it's not guaranteed that the UFC, he might think of other things for himself to do, as he is known to from time to time. The UFC might think of other things for him to do that are just more lucrative. And I wouldn't blame the UFC if they also had a little bit of reservations about putting a belt back on Conor McGregor, because who knows then if you see him again. If he defends it according to any reasonable timeline. I think that a Conor McGregor win just opens up the possibilities a little more than... I think Dustin Poirier wins, and it's guaranteed he's going to turn right around and fight Chuck Yollis for that belt.
Yeah, and in a certain way, to me, it would almost feel like a relief if we could move Conor McGregor fully into the fun fights territory phase of his career, where you could have him fight Nate Diaz again, where you could have him fight Jorge Masvidal, whatever ideas you think could make money with Conor McGregor, and we could all feel good about that. I feel like even if he were to beat Dustin Poirier, which is certainly not out of the question, like he could definitely land a hot one early in that fight and win by knockout. But even if that happens, don't you kind of get the feeling like, oh man, if Conor McGregor is still going to be wading around in the thick of the lightweight contender pool, it's kind of going to waste a lot of our time. Like we're kind of going to be shackled to him and his whims. And I'm not even sure what the ceiling for the guy's fates in that division would be, even if he beat Dustin Poirier. In certain ways, Charles Oliveira and Conor McGregor is kind of an interesting matchup because, you know, we saw in the Michael Chandler fight that Charles Oliveira is somewhat vulnerable to McGregor's strengths, and like he could get punched earlier in that fight and could conceivably lose it. But I also feel like if Oliveira is able to weather an early storm from McGregor, which seems entirely possible, it kind of starts to feel like a cakewalk to me for Charles Oliveira, just because of the way he is able to be a technical striker. The tools that he has on the ground just gives him so many more ways to win than I think a guy like Conor McGregor. But when I think about Dustin Poirier, I don't think any of those things. I think a fight between Charles Oliveira and Dustin Poirier would be an absolute goddamn barn burner from start to finish. And if I could, I would break into the UFC's office and shred all of the paperwork for McGregor versus Poirier and just book a goddamn title fight between Oliveira versus Poirier, because I think it would be fun as shit to watch. What about some of the other people in this division, though? Like, as we mentioned, we now have kind of like a murderer's row here, so to speak. Justin Gaethje, Beneil Dariush, Michael Chandler needs something to do in the wake of this loss. People talked obviously about a Justin Gaethje, Michael Chandler fight, as you brought up earlier. We need to pick up the pieces a little bit here with Tony Ferguson. And oh yeah, you've also got Beneil Dariush, Rafael Dos Anjos, Gregor Gillespie now back on the winning ways, and Islam Makhachev also back in action and scooping up wins here. That just feels like, again, I feel like we have this conversation every so often about lightweight, but maybe it has just been a while since we've really been able to say this as we moved on from Habib. But it feels like we just have another shark tank here, just like a lineup of guys, any one of which could have amazing fights with any other member of this elite group, any one of which who could conceivably wear the gold, frankly.
Yeah. Well, and you know, somebody was asking me about Charles Oliveira, like how long should we expect him reasonably to reign as lightweight champion, especially given how competitive the division is, and that the flip side to him having this sort of inspiring late career, finally getting to the title fight after so many years in the UFC and so many fights, is that has he suffered so much damage along the way that it will affect his ability to stay on top in that situation. And, it might, like, frankly, like, if you told me, like, okay, he's got a window of opportunity here. He's, I think, 31, has been doing this for a little over a decade, and I could see how that stuff is going to catch up to you eventually, and it might be while you're facing the absolute best of the best, trying to hold it down as UFC champion. But then you look around at the top guys in the division, and they're all pretty much in that situation. I mean, Michael Chandler at 35 is one of the older guys, but they all have similar experience, and most of them have been through those sort of ups and downs. And that's the problem with having a division that's as competitive as this, and the way the UFC does matchmaking, the different approach than you see in boxing, where it feels like almost everybody who fights for a title is like 30-0. And in the UFC, especially in a division like this, in order to even get to that point, you have been through some shit. You have been through some really hard fights against some tough people, and that stuff can take a toll. And so I think that does make it really hard to predict just how long anybody could really hold down that belt, unless you're sort of a generational talent like Khabib Nurmagomedov was.
Yeah. What about Beneil Dariush? He seems like a guy who had a big win over the weekend, but also, you know, in some ways is at risk, I think, of getting lost in the shuffle a little bit here as we start to sort out what is going on with Charles Oliveira. And as you mentioned earlier in the show, people on social media were quick to jump on a Justin Gaethje versus Michael Chandler fight, just because I think stylistically it would be bananas. But to my mind, if you start thinking about Justin Gaethje as a potential number one contender, given that his most recent loss was to Khabib Nurmagomedov, and who is now retired and not on the scene anymore, obviously, I started to think Beneil Dariush versus Justin Gaethje would not be a fight that I would be mad at all, especially if you think that Dariush and Gaethje are both going to have to fight one more time while we figure out the right guy sweepstakes and find out who's going to fight Charles Oliveira. So, like, I don't know. I started to think about Beneil Dariush. I hope that he doesn't get overshadowed here by McGregor and Poirier and some of these other guys who are going to be doing it at a top level. I would like to see him fight someone like Justin Gaethje for something resembling a title eliminator here in the next, you know, season or so.
Yeah. I mean, and that's a fight that's tough to call in a lot of ways, but I wouldn't be mad at that. I mean, again, you can make a lot of different matchups here, and there's hardly a way to make a bad one with who you have sitting around at lightweight right now. It's just such a tough division where you got so many good fighters in the top five that you look outside of that, like even the guys who are ranked like 8, 9, 10, and they're really talented fighters, but also you feel like in this division, you still seem like you are 4 or 5 fights away from a title at that point, just because there's just so much else going on.
Potentially one of the most interesting things, I think, will be to see what happens to Tony Ferguson. And as you look at this list, I don't even know who you slot him up against, like considering where he is at his career, where he is in his career at this point. You'd like to think that Tony Ferguson will get a competitive fight and not necessarily someone who's going to assuredly send him to his fourth straight loss. But like, I don't know who that person would be at this point if you're going to give him a relevant matchup.
Yeah. Yeah, but I still think, I mean, one of the things about being the Weirdsmobile that is Tony Ferguson is that even 3 straight losses, people are still interested in seeing you.
Yeah, that is true. That is true. All right, Ben, let's do Just Saying Stuff, and then we'll get out of here for this week. Ben, I have a tweet. I have a tweet from the future.
Oh, good.
I built a time machine.
Okay.
I traveled to the future, and naturally I used that awesome power to read the Twitter timelines of noted MMA fighters. So
that sounds like you. That sounds like something you'd do.
I have a tweet by Conor McGregor from the day after he fights Charles Oliveira for the lightweight championship.
Okay.
All right, are you ready?
Yeah, lay it on me.
Here's a future tweet from Conor McGregor. He writes, "Well, !" It's a mad game. I had no way of knowing my opponent could choke me with my own arm. I will go back to the gym and train defense for this move. Looking forward to the rematch once I am fully prepared." I'm just saying.
You know, I'm just saying. This is why you're such a successful fiction writer, is your ability to just get into the head of a character.
Manifest these worlds.
The diction, the worldview, everything. It's all right there.
I'm just saying.
Well, Chad, this week I'm just saying, Angela Hill has put me in a tough spot.
Okay. How? Explain.
Well, Angela Hill is pretty good at doing her own self-promotion. God knows the UFC isn't doing a lot of it. And also good at coming up with her own merchandise. And she has a new t-shirt out, Chad. This t-shirt, I'm looking at it right now on ProWrestlingTees.com. You can find it among all her other merchandise there at prowrestlingtees.com/AngieOverkill. And it is a picture of the Goya painting of Saturn devouring his son. And underneath that, she has put in big red letters, "Bitch fucking season." Now, obviously I would like to buy this t-shirt.
Yeah, but I see a problem. I see a problem.
I would like to support Angela Hill. I think that's kind of a rad idea to repurpose this Goya painting as an MMA t-shirt. And the whole thing that she has had, we're talking about how it seems to be constantly bitch fucking season as far as Angie Hill is concerned. But then I picture myself going about my daily life. I picture myself pulling open the drawer, seeing the bitch fucking season t-shirt in there, thinking about putting it on. And then thinking through everywhere I might have to go during the day, which is basically the grocery store, picking up my kids from school, or, you know, down to the gas station to get a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
Now that I'm fully vaxxed, maybe to the bar on the corner to sit there with a glass of whiskey and watch the NHL playoffs. And then I picture myself in the bitch fucking season t-shirt. And I picture my interactions with the world as a result of that t-shirt.
Yep.
I picture what I look like. What messages they get when they see me. And then they see the bitch fucking season. And I go, I just don't know if I can do it. Much as I want to support her. If I buy it, I'm just going to have to, it's going to have to be a home t-shirt. You know? But I guess what I would say is this. There are others of you out there in the listening audience who could pull off this bitch fucking season t-shirt. You know? Tracy Dickinson walks around in the bitch fucking season t-shirt. I'm not saying she's going to have zero problems, but she's not going to have the same kind of problems I'm going to have.
Yeah.
Think about it. You know? Because it is a rad shirt and I want someone out there to be getting the use out of it. It just... Not sure that someone is me. I'm just saying.
Remember last week when we talked about the Smashing Machine, the Mark Kerr documentary on the movie club, and we talked about the scene where he's in the waiting room at the doctor's office and there's an old lady in there and he's got to explain to her what MMA is.
Because now she makes the mistake of getting in his business by asking about his bruises, but yeah.
And now imagine you're sitting there in your bitch fucking season t-shirt.
Yep.
Awkward.
I feel like the real danger, I wear my Middle Easy t-shirt sometimes that has the Waleed Ishmael rant just written across it. And there, you know, that one perplexes a lot of grocery store cashiers. But they will at least then like engage you about it. They ask you about it and you tell them, look, it's not worth either of our time for me to explain it. But this one, I feel like the real danger is they're not going to ask about it. No, they're just going to look at it, look at me, and leap to some conclusions. And then there we are.
Yeah, you are going to have to register for some kind of watch list if you wear that t-shirt, and that's, we don't need that. In any case, that's going to do it for this week's Co-Main Event podcast. We're out of here. We'll be over at the Patreon all week with the Wednesday live chat, the Thursday movie club where we're watching The Raid, and of course, then the Friday Power Hour as we cruise into a weekend where Cody Garbs is going to return from his long haul COVID-19 symptoms and he's going to fight Rob Font at bantamweight at this UFC Fight Night event. Also on this card, Ben Rothwell making what seems like kind of a fast turnaround here to get back in the cage. This is where we're going to put the Jack Hermanson versus Edmund Shabazian fight that was supposed to be at UFC 262 but got scratched. A women's featherweight fight, the rare women's featherweight fight with Felicia Spencer and Norma Dumont Viana. So maybe some stuff you want to watch on there. I don't know. And then we'll be back Monday with another episode of The Proper to break down everything that happens. As for right now, though, we are done. We are through. We are out. Now, see, one thing for you to consider, though, is that it might not be that big a deal. Because your face basically says it's bitch fucking season all the time anyway. So
that's true.
Just having a shirt to back that up might not be too bad.
But see, I worry. Then I'm confirming for everyone what they already assumed about me upon seeing this visage.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
They look at me and they're going, especially if I'm going to be walking around maskless these days, fully vaccinated, and then they're going to see the whole thing and they're going to go, I bet for that guy it is. Oh, yeah, no, there it is. Says it right on his t-shirt. Suspicion's confirmed.